meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Dana Pretzer Show. There's a great new book out called Confessions of a Mafia Boss Gas Pipe. It's by Philip Carlo, and you can go to philipcarlo.com or just go to the link that we have set up in the show notes. It talks about Anthony Gaspipe Casso. He's a feared boss of the Lucchese crime family. He was jailed in 1993. I think he's doing 400 years or something like that. It's always fascinating to read the mafia books, the inside books, and this author that we're going to be interviewing here very shortly, Philip Carlo, he's really on the inside when it comes to talking to Gaspipe. Welcome to the show, sir.
Very nice to be here, as always.
Now, am I reading this right? You were neighbors, were you not?
When I was about 13 years old, Anthony and his wife, Lillian, moved right next door to us. We lived in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, and there was a high concentration of mafia members in that area. And we knew that, and we knew too that Anthony was connected, but it really didn't matter. As it happened, my parents became friendly with him and his wife. They vacationed together. They were in our house having dinner frequently. And after 7 years or so, they moved away, and we kind of lost track with them. He quickly moved up the ladder of the Lucchese family, ended up becoming the head of the family, which was a very vaulted position. In New York, as your listeners might know, there were five major families, and Anthony was the go-to guy when somebody in another family wanted someone killed. He was very good at murder. Now, I don't say this lightly, and I don't say this as though he went and got a gun and killed people. He set up the killings. He arranged for them. Most often, they had to do with people becoming informers, giving the police information, not knowing that Anthony had both NYPD detectives and FBI agents in his back pocket. He had more cops working for him than all the heads of the families put together. That was one of the things that made him unusual, one of the things that made him that much more successful, for want of a better word. And he was ruthless. I mean, King Lear, ruthless. He would, at the bat of an eye, someone would die, or people, more than someone would die, one person would die. And it was always in his mind to protect the families, to protect the business. And he hated rats.
Right.
With a passion. Yet, years later, he ended up becoming the thing he hated the most, which is a book unto itself.
I'll bet. Now, he's responsible for more than 50 murders. He's serving 13 life sentences at a federal prison in Colorado. When you sat down with him, was it... me saying difficult is being naive, but it's two friends from the neighborhood, I guess, sitting down and talking is something that we in the everyday public think of as a movie, but this is real life.
Yeah, it was, and it is. And I think I managed because of that. Well, first off, when he was arrested, I began writing him letters, thinking that it would be a very good book if I can get him to talk.
Sure.
I'd already written The Night Stalker. I was contemplating another book. I later wrote The Ice Man, which was about a serial killer, contract killer for the mafia. Was a serial killer and became a contact killer. Ultimately, it was very difficult to find him because the federal government was insulating him, protecting him, moving him around. Long story short, after a while, I did find him. He did agree to do a book with me. And I not only managed to get from him the Houghton, the names, places, dates, etc., but I managed to get the heart and the soul, the heartbeat, a black heart, a black soul, yes, granted. But it was, for me, an amazing journey into that world, that place, that society. And it really is a society, a secret society, an underground society, another world in which you have to murder someone to get into it. That makes you one of them, that makes you contemporary, that makes you liable for arrest. The theory was if you kill somebody, you can't rat anybody else out, and you are one of us.
Right.
Anthony was killed when he was 19 years old, at the behest of a captain in the Lucchese family. Didn't know the guy, he was in the After Hours Club. They brought the guy there thinking he was going to be in a poker game, and they left him at the bar, and Anthony was talking about the weather and nothing in particular with him, and in the bat of an eye, he pulled out a .32 revolver, put it to his head, and shot him. And it meant nothing to him, nothing.
Oh, jeez.
It was just a matter of business, it was a matter of doing what he was asked to do. And thus he earned what they called, he earned his bones, as they say, and he was, when the books were open, able to become a member. There really is a ceremony at which the sponsoring mafioso is there. It's usually a captain or somebody higher up, and they do take an oath, and they swear allegiance, and they swear too that their own families, wives and children, mother and father, all become second to the crime family. And they swear silence. And like that, they become members. For many, many, many years, from Sicily, days in Sicily, on in the late 1800s, they were so amazingly successful because they really did keep their mouth shut. They didn't talk. They were, in a sense, a society of honest men. And eventually, I mean, initially they were fighting corrupt landowners. They were fighting corrupt government. They were fighting different peoples that came to Sicily to subjugate the Sicilians and steal what they had. Every power in England and in Europe came to Sicily and tried to take over the country, the island, actually.
Right.
It was a country island. But consistently, the Sicilians beat them through treachery and murder, and ultimately, nobody could out-murder these people. Eventually, the society became corrupted, and they started taking and stealing and killing for selfish reasons. And when there was the great migration of Italians from Italy to the United States in the years 1890 and 1915, let's say, a lot of mafiosos came here. They set up shop, and they were amazingly successful. Lucky Luciano had the idea to set it up like corporations. And they formed the five families in New York, and they ran them like corporations. They'd have meetings several times a year to discuss different strategies, different ways to divvy up different scams. As an example would be when they took over Cuba.
Right.
At the behest of Meyer Lansky. A brilliant individual. I mean, literally a brilliant man.
Yep.
But he went the other way, and chose a life of crime. But they owned Cuba. They owned their hotels there. They were very, very, very successful, making millions of dollars every week. And it wasn't Americans that were just going there and spending money, partying. Europeans came there, and it was just basically the playground for the world. And then, of course, Castro did what he did, and everything turned around. But what they were trying to do was become legitimate. they just happened to end disputes or finalize disputes with a murder. And a couple of particularly psychopathic individuals came along and really opened the eyes of society to how outrageously violent and, in a sense, stupidly violent it can become. Al Capone's a good example.
Right.
Albert Anastasia is a good example. He started an outfit called Murder Incorporated.
Murder Inc., yep.
And they were literally selling murder contracts. And this flew in the face of what the mafia was about. It wasn't supposed to be killing people because one business partner in the bagel store wanted to kill his partner. The murder was always in conjunction with righting a wrong. And it was never about somebody's paying somebody to kill somebody. And ultimately, they named Anastasia the Mad Hatter, and they killed him. They killed him because he was out of line. They killed him because he was drawing attention to them. He was making unnecessary noise. For your listeners' benefit, he was taking a shave when Joe Gallo and Carmine Persico walked into a barbershop in Manhattan and just blew him away while he was getting a shave.
Right. Absolutely.
What they were trying to do there, and I guess to a degree what they did do there, was they were cleaning house. They were trying to avoid the notoriety, the press. John Gotti would be another good example of somebody who's creating heat rather than working behind the scenes and nobody knowing what he's doing. A good example of the opposite would be Carlo Gambino. He dressed like a superintendent, didn't have a fancy house or car, yet he was the head of the Gambino crime family, the largest family that ever existed. John Gotti eventually took control of that family by killing Paul Castellano. That murder, that particular murder, is very interesting. May I tell you a bit about it?
Absolutely. And if you're just tuning in, New York Times bestselling author Philip Carlo is here, and we're talking about his new book, Gas Pipe. And, you know, anything mafioso, the public's fascinated with it. And let's continue on.
Well, John Gotti wanted to be the head of the family. And he, in order to take that position over, without the murder being sanctioned, without permission, he killed Paul Castellano in a very public way in front of a busy restaurant a few days before Christmas. And it was front page news. Paul Castellano, there he is, lying on the ground, blood, and in a pool of blood. And there was a commission meeting. And at this point, the commission consisted only of the Lucchese family and the Chingigante family. Bananos were thrown off the commission because they were openly dealing drugs. The Colombo family was at war with one another, and they were not allowed in the commission. The Persicos and the Colombos were fighting each other. Every other week there was another murder, creating heat for everybody, creating police scrutiny. So the Chin and Anthony decided John Gotti had to go, because he killed the head of a family without it being sanctioned. Conversely, an example of a sanction, head of the killing of the head of a family, will be a guy named Carmen Galante, who took over the Bonanno family, was the hourly dealing drugs, and they murdered him in a garden restaurant, and it became, in broad daylight, 12:30 in the afternoon, it became a worldwide famous photograph.
Yep.
Because his glasses were askew and a cigar was sticking out of his mouth.
Yes, I've seen it. Yeah.
Okay. Most all of us have. Well, there we have an example of the head of a family being killed, and the people that did it were made captains because this guy had to go. More trouble than it was worth. Having said that, John put together a wolf pack that brought down Paul Castellano. Afterwards, he figured he can get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a sit-down, and the sit-down in itself was very interesting because it happened in the middle of the night to avoid FBI scrutiny, to avoid any kind of scrutiny. And what they did was they came to a garage in the West Village that had one secret door leading to another secret door. And they went from one end of the block to the other end of the block without anyone knowing it. And they had a meeting in a beat-up little tenement apartment. And here you have the three most powerful people in organized crime sitting down in a beat-up old tenement. But they managed to avoid scrutiny. There was no bug there. And they voted Chin and Gaspipe. John Gotti as boss of bosses, and they welcomed him into the commission. Now, what's interesting is they did this knowing they were going to kill him. They did this to get him to drop his guard. It was all the charade. And I said to Anthony, I mean, why go through all this? And he said to relax him, to make him think it's okay.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier being a friend and wanting to kill somebody than being an enemy. But John thought everything was okay. The next day, his teams, like hungry sharks, started following him around. They even brought in his teams from Sicily, because Paul Castellano was Sicilian, and he had Sicilian relatives that wanted blood. So, as it happened, Gotti was surrounded by press, surrounded by FBI agents, always under scrutiny, and difficult to get next to. They kept trying. They were persevering. He had a social club, literally, in Manhattan, and they figured they'd get him there. But what happened is, because of traffic, they could never get close enough, or if they saw an opportunity, they couldn't get away because of traffic. And because of the traffic jams, lack of parking, literally, actually saved John Gotti's life. At a point in time, Anthony got the three teams he had put together. And, what's going on? What's happening here? And they're like, boss, there's never anywhere to park. And the other night, Tuesday night, we had a shot at him. But there was bumper-to-bumper traffic.
Jeez, that's something, isn't it?
It's like you can't make this stuff up. And so, ultimately, he wasn't murdered, shot down in the street. But John got arrested and went away and ultimately died a miserable death from cancer.
Skin cancer, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it was throat cancer and several different cancers that spread throughout his whole body.
I'm just curious, while I've got you here for the last couple of minutes, and again, if you're just tuning in, Philip Carlo is here. He has a new book called Gaspipe. Look for the link on our show notes. When you talk about the fascination of the public with mafioso, John Gotti, whoever, we could do a whole hour show. Sadly, we're down to 3 minutes. And then when we see, I'm not sure if you ever saw the A&E program Growing Up Gotti, and
sure.
And the almost the idol of the family and their mob boss dad. Is society totally out to lunch when it comes to this? Are we glorifying these mobsters? And that's what it went through, you know, in the 50s and 60s and 30s and 40s. They were put on a high pedestal, and it continues on today.
Well, to answer your question, the only time I saw Growing Up Gotti was when I was changing channels that happened to come by.
Yeah.
With a bad taste.
Exactly. Absolutely.
And it was like bottom feeding fish.
Yeah.
And what bottom feeding fish do.
Yes.
And having said that, I think society's fascination with the mob in general is because of the power.
Yeah.
Power, the cars, the homes, the fact that they're family oriented, very patriotic, they dress well, and this is all very, very appealing. Anthony owned a bar, a fancy bar, called the 19th Hole, and the bar was lined up with women who wanted to get involved with mob guys because they knew they were oversexed, they knew they had a lot of money, and they knew they were available. And more importantly, more than anything, power is an aphrodisiac.
Yeah.
I mean, since the beginning of time, everybody wanted to have sex with Julius Caesar. Everyone wants to have sex with Cleopatra. everyone did have sex with Peter Kravets.
That's true. That's true. One last question before I let you go, and I really appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure.
You've written about Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, and when I look at his picture and I look at Anthony Casso's picture, I look at their eyes. And I look at both sets of eyes looking back at me, and you talked about that journey, that story that is in those eyes. Is it just me, or how important is
no,
that?
It's not, actually. Well, contraire. What it is you're being observant. What we're talking about here are eyes that are dead. It's like a pool of black oil. Let's see Ramirez's eyes.
Yep.
And I've seen that in all of them, dead flat, almost soulless eyes. Even when Anthony was in our house having dinner with us on Sunday afternoon, sometimes I'd look left, right, and I'd look in his eyes, and I thought to myself, "Guy's a killer."
Yep.
You know, he's a stone cold killer. Ramirez is in a class of his own because he entered homes in the middle of the night with a gun in one hand and his penis in the other hand.
Yeah.
And he's a sexual sadist whose motivation was a bloodlust. And whoever was home, he killed, he raped. He did it for 14 months. And I don't think in the annals of crime history has any one individual so scared an entire community of 14 million people in L.A. County as this particular individual did.
Absolutely, and the old saying that a picture paints a thousand words, in this case, the eyes paint a thousand words. Philip Carlo, thank you. Let's do this again sometime.
Anytime. I'm available for you. I'd love to do it. Just set it up, and I'll be there for you.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome.
Bye-bye. The book is Gas Pipe. It's about the Mafia. It's a fascinating read, and I suggest you go out and take a look at it. We're going to take a break here on Scared Monkeys Radio, and we'll be back with former police officer, current author of a new book called The Devil's Closet, Stacy Dietrich. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
It's the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. And now back to the show.
You know, in the 70s and early 80s, when we thought about police women, we thought about Angie Dickinson and Cagney and Lacey, or whatever they were called. I forget that now. And it was almost, it was supportive, but it was almost degrading to the part that, you got to have Angie Dickinson or you have to have Sharon Gless out there portraying the police woman. There's a lot more to it now. They're in the streets. They're working. They're doing the same kind of beat work. They're doing the same kind of investigative work. They're in the mud and the blood and the beer, if you want to call it that. And one of my favorite guests here is former police officer, current author, Stacy Dietrich. She has a new book coming out called The Devil's Closet. Welcome back to the show, ma'am.
Hi, Dana. Thanks for having me.
You're not. Are you Angie Dickinson or Cagney and Lacey? Remember those shows?
I do remember those. I can't say that, boy, that is a blast from the past.
Well, Angie Dickinson, policewoman, that goes back to the early 70s.
I think my parents watched that. I do remember, the whole Cagney and Lacey
Your
thing.
Parents? Well, hell, I watched that show. I loved it. Angie Dickinson, what a babe. How could she could go out and she could run in those stiletto high heels, carry the little snub nose 38, and not only could she get 6 shots from it, she could get 14 shots from it.
I know. Yeah, of course. It's amazing because I have a really nice, it's no longer in production, one of the Colt Detective Special 38s, which it's a classy girly gun, and I love it. But, you see these shows, they shoot 20 shots out of 6. It's amazing.
How long were you on the job?
Oh, gosh. I started in 1992 as a police dispatcher at Mansfield City, where my father and my uncles and my husband work. And from there, went to the police academy.
You know what? The dispatchers are our front line. God bless them. They do the work of everyone, and we can't say enough good about our dispatchers. In fact, in a lot of places, they're not treated very well, and they should be.
No, I'll tell you, I've spewed out a few myself when I'm in my car and they're dispatching. I have to say, I've thrown some things out at them before. Mm-hmm. They do take a lot of abuse. I'll give them that. But that's their thing. you can either take it or you don't.
Okay, so you dispatched, and then where'd you go?
I started out in a small city department. I was one of two first females ever hired.
Wow.
So that one in itself was just an experience like no other.
Mm-hmm.
And funny that we're having this conversation because, you know, I have my fiction detective series coming out, and I'm also working on my first true crime, which will be out next September, but we had an editor from New York call and want me to do a memoir on being a female police officer. So it's called Stumbling Along the Beat.
And, that's a great title.
May 10. Yeah, it's interesting writing it, I'll tell you. It's bringing back a lot of memories.
There's that stigma, and I hate to use that term, but there is. And
okay.
In fact, it still goes on today. You know, you get the old pot-bellied desk sergeant. That's
my dad.
Yeah, and that's my dad, and sadly, that's me. Although I don't fly the desk, I'm on the road, but there's a little bit different, you know, 25, 26 years ago when I started this job than there is today. And, you know, the gals that are out there, the female officers, they're doing just as much as anyone else, in fact, a little bit more, because there's a lot of investigations, you know, whether it's rape, child abuse, call it what you want, where thank God that there's a female to come around and have that little different perspective, but they can also come in and do the job.
Right. And, you know, I was a little, I think, better off than most. You know, my family is very well known in the area. So, you know, when I went into the job, it was, oh, she's one of the Wendling kids. You know, she's Joe's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was familiar. So I got a little bit more flack than I think some others did. But keep in mind, you know, there is that pressure. They want to see that first time, boy, that you can walk in there and handle yourself. And it's so funny. I remember when I made my debut and walked into a bar fight of 30 people alone and, you know, did it for the sole purpose of, okay, this is my chance. I would never in a million years do that again. Because now when I look back, I'm like, that's so stupid. You know what I mean? But
yep.
At the time, it was like, okay, this is my chance. I got to do it. And, you know, I grabbed, you know, you're grabbing people and went around the neck and one by the foot, and you're dragging them out, and, you know, here comes the guys, and they're like, hey, she went right in there, and you know, it got better from there.
Hubby's an officer, so you just can't seem to get away from the police part of it, but when it comes to that, it's in our blood, isn't it?
Absolutely, and, you know, my dad is still on the job, which just...
Is he? God bless him.
Oh, God bless him, but it's phenomenal. You know, 4 years in Vietnam, went right into policing, 40 years now on
wow.
the job, and now he's still a uniform lieutenant on night shift. He's my husband's boss. So
good for him.
Yeah. You know, he still loves it. I think to talk to him about getting out of it, he's like horrified. Oh, I still like my job. Keep in mind, you know, I had been around it since birth. I mean, we had a very unusual family. You know, there was four brothers that are police officers, and one was ultimately shot in 79 and had to leave the job. And he didn't die, but he still has lots of health problems because of it. But our family reunions were just bizarre. I mean, you know, they had been in and out of homicide and had crime scene photos, and we pass those around, you know, when we're kids. Now, they probably call out children's services, but, you know, back then, it was normal for us. Our weekends were spent going down to my grandparents' farm that was in all these woods, and I shot my first gun when I was four, you know, shooting at pop cans, and, you know, it was completely normal for me, and I think growing up like that, I found myself maybe getting burnt out a little quicker than most.
Yep. You know, my dad, God bless him, he's still alive. He worked 38 years before he retired out, only because of age. And, you know, growing up, idolizing your father because of what he did, and then myself working as a police officer, although in a different community, and he still working as a police officer, there was that tight bond where you could, like you say, you sit down and you talk about, you know, most families sit down and they talk about, you know, Aunt Bessie and her cat. We're talking about the latest, homicide we're working on, or a bunch of break-in robberies, whatever. But that's, you know, that's just that. And I agree with you as far as the burnout factor goes, because you started at a very early age. But what got you into writing? And, of course, your most recent book, The Devil's Closet, is something we're going to talk about here in a few minutes, too.
Well, you know, it's so funny because everybody asks me that, and I don't have, like, that one answer. I really don't know. About 5 or 6 years ago, 4 years ago, I had, you know, transferred departments and had been at that one for about 2 years. And we were building a house, and the street was, you know, a war zone. The hot summers are just horrific. And just kind of those, I feel like I'm going to explode and what to do. And I had come upon a case that was very unusual, and I never forget this. My husband and I, we were sitting at the construction site of our home with a fire drinking beer, and I was telling him about this story, and he goes, you know, that'd make a really great book. You should write that. And I'm like, come on, you know, what am I going to do? I can't write this book. And he goes, no, really, you should. Well, 6 months later, I just happened to sit down in front of my computer, and I'm like, well, we'll see how it goes. And I started to write. I wrote 5 pages of the first book in the C.C. Gallagher series. And I came up with the characters' names, and I found myself really getting into this and identifying with these characters and going into this other place when I was writing. I emerged from that little place just feeling refreshed and calm and at ease. And as I got halfway through the book, I thought, you know, I had not intended on getting this published. I thought, you know, maybe I'll give it a shot. And I knew I had to get an agent first and how hard that was. But I ended up, after I finished the first manuscript, I had an agent, I think, less than a month later, which was, okay, well, maybe this is what it's meant to be. And it just kind of went from there. It's been really a fun ride.
You know, it's an escape mechanism. You know, true story here. 3 o'clock this morning, I'm standing down at a local bar, at a bar brawl, helping the boys load up a guy that got clocked with a beer bottle over the head. And I'm thinking to myself, what kind of questions I'm going to ask you on tonight's show?
Isn't that hysterical?
Yeah, isn't that something? And because it's a way to get around this. You know, I'm a street supervisor, so I'm down in the fights, and I'm doing all this kind of stuff, and I'm thinking about this. The show, and it's such a good escape mechanism, and you know it's so fantastic to see people like yourself that are able to go with it and share the experiences as a police officer all this time, because it's not just on the street, it never leaves your blood, you just keep doing it no matter how you do it. Let's talk about The Devil's Closet.
Okay, but I wanted to touch on something really quick with your bar story.
Sure.
Nobody believes me when I say that when you get into your stories, they're just, you really get into them. And one day, I was in this really, really bad part of town, and I saw this truck with a West Virginia plate on it. And I quick flip around on it, and I'm getting my mic. I'm like, we had that in roll call. It's stolen or it's wanted for something. I can't remember what it is. As I get ready to run the plate, it dawns on me that I am not looking for this truck. You know, C.C. Gallagher in my book was looking for this. And I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? And I just thought, wow, maybe we need to separate a little bit there. But you know, you go 2 to 3 days and you're constantly in these characters writing. It was just a subconscious thought. Well, as soon as I saw that truck and plate, it was so funny.
You know, it's the human side and the police side. It's very hard for us to take off our police skin. And I know that sounds gross, and turn into the human. But you know what? There's nothing wrong with having that police thing going on all the time, whether it's talking about your book or me doing this radio show. The Devil's Closet is something that I had when I was a kid. My parents used to get after me because I never cleaned it. No, that's not what this is about, is it?
Mine have it today.
Yeah.
My kids.
And you know, you've got a website, too. I've been remiss. I think that's the term. Stacy Dittrich, D-I-T-T-R-I-C-H. I could say that phonetically, but the listeners would get bored. .com. Let's talk about The Devil's Closet.
Okay, The Devil's Closet. The first book in the Cece Gallagher series was Murder Mountain, which is what I was telling you about.
Right.
We put that to the side because The Devil's Closet I ended up writing immediately after that, and it came out to be such a much more stronger book. So we can always go back and do the prequel thing. So we started on this. The story, when I was in the Detective Bureau, I had come upon a case of a man with child pornography. And, you know, interviewing him, something was off. It just, you know, I remember sitting across the table from him and blurting out, all right, so what ages of girls are you attracted to? And as plain as day, he looks at me and says, between 5 and 8.
Jeez.
So I said, you know, I had an FBI agent with me, which is not, and let me make this clear, because my friends, I hear this all the time, is not the FBI agent in the book. He totally fixed it. She has an affair with him. That's why I'm saying this.
Okay.
But there's a little romance in there, too.
Sure.
But to make a long story short, this man had this house of horrors, to say the least. And he, you know, as a kid, you get those little life-size dolls that are like 2 to 3 feet.
Yep.
I don't know if you've ever seen those.
Sure, yeah.
Closet full of them. He dressed them. He would attach female genitalia to these dolls. It was a horrific experience. And he said, these are keeping me from hurting somebody.
Jeez.
And, you know, you look at his life and you think, there's no way in hell that this man has gone this long. You could see where he had escalated and never touched a child, hurt a child. He traveled a lot. So I had this theory going in my head, and it was so scary. And you know how prosecutors and district attorneys are. You know, the evidence wasn't there to pursue this.
Yep.
We had him on the one charges. And, you know, through all this, he hated me, obviously. I think he left 60 voicemail messages on my office phone over a weekend, because I took his favorite doll, which is also in the book, and threatened to cut my throat. I had a forensic psychiatrist call me at home, said, he's sitting in here. If I let him go, he's going to come over and kill you. There's no doubt in my mind. So we had to revoke his bond and send him back to prison. But so this is basically, that is the story that inspired the story with Cece and her characters in this book. It goes beyond what my theory was. You know, she investigates this guy. There's these Amber Alerts going on. You know, finds out he is pursuing her as well, and there's a reason for that at the end of the book. She ultimately finds his closet with these dolls and you know, all these kids. There's multiple kids missing, and you know, finds out at the end of the story that he's responsible for the deaths of numerous children over the last 25 years. It's just this huge thing, and it really it's one of those things that people don't like to read about things like that. And there's so much information, accurate information there about sex offenders and pedophiles. You know, I did the subplot of the romance thing to kind of ease it a bit. Because, you know, people are disturbed by that.
Sure, yeah.
So if they can read just a good book and there's some romance in there, but they're still walking away with, oh my gosh, now I know this. And that's a good thing.
As an author, when you write a book, or as a show host, when you host a show, you want to do something that will attract your audience, will attract your reader, will want them to pick up the book and read it. And or listen to the show, so you have that little bit there. But there's other aspects of it, like you say, the disturbing aspects that the people may not want to pick up the book if that's all they hear about. How do you do that as an author? You got a new book coming up too, Murder Behind the Badge. It's going to be coming out September 2009. People will see that right away, and of course there's that huge public fascination. But what is that little catch that you put out there for the public so they want to pick up your book and read it, or they're interested?
Well, the Murder Behind the Badge is my first true crime, and The Devil's Closet is out this October, followed by the second book in the series, Mary Jane's Grave, will be out in May. And I think what has been neat for me and what the feedback I'm getting is that, you know, yeah, she's my alter ego to a point. They're inspired by these true stories. You know, they're good. They're fast reads. You know, these are the go to the beach and read this in one day kind of a book. But again, I think the mystery of knowing that it came from somewhere real, I think, is a lot of the catch. And again, you know, me being a police officer and writing about this female detective, and I think it's just a great platform at this point for me. It's just, the response has been shocking, to say the least, over all this.
You know, in the last, I'll go back 5 years, until recently here in the last couple, we haven't heard a lot, or at least there wasn't a lot of PR or media reports as far as bad cops. In fact, I'm in my 11th year of doing this program now, and I hated doing stories about bad cops because I've always been one to say that we don't hear enough stories about good cops, like yourself, but then the bad cops need to be exposed too. And now the media is jumping on every case, rightfully so. I don't think there's one Bobby Cutts, Drew Peterson, you know, we could go on and on that they haven't or shouldn't have reported. But what is that stigma that is out there as far as, you know, the public wants to hear about the bad cop, but departments, in fact, I think do a terrible job promoting the good cops?
They absolutely do. And I got to tell you, and you know as well as I do, I think, you know, when I finally decided enough's enough full time and I wanted to pursue my writing full time, a lot of it's not the street. It's not the street that burns out cops and makes them lose their compassion and their drive. It's actually the department itself.
Yep.
And, you know, you get, I don't think people realize the scope of politics within a police department is so phenomenal. And it's, you know, so many days you walk out with the worst taste in your mouth. You get, you know, passed over for positions for some type of political reason, you know, things like that. And, you know, you go out and you do your job every day and you're putting your life on the line for everybody and you enjoy doing that, only to come back and have your own people question you and rank you over the coals. And that's very disheartening for, you know, somebody in on the street uniform level. Those are the guys. Those are the ones there that are going out every day. And one of the best quotes I've ever heard is, a police officer is a peacetime soldier always at war.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and
wow.
That is, it should be treated as such.
Absolutely. If you're just tuning in, Stacey Dietrich is here. Go to her webpage. There's a link on the show notes. Her latest book to be coming out here is called The Devil's Closet. As a women in crime contributor, we've had you on the show before. We've had a lot of the gals on the program before. It's interesting to see the different scope of personality on that blog, everywhere from police officers to media people to DAs to defense attorneys to you name it, it's there, profilers, authors. I think it's so refreshing to see a group of gals being able to come on and talk about the stories that they talk about, write about the stories that they talk about, and see that there really isn't that much difference when you look at the system itself. All the parties involved are pretty much on the same page when it comes to issues of today. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you something, you would think with a group of women.
I know where you're going with this.
You would think, you know, and there are days, don't get me wrong, and when we're all trying to vote on something or agree, and my BlackBerry starts going off a mile a minute, and I always laugh, I go, oh, the Women in Crime Inc. got something going on, I better jump in. Because, you know, we're, you know, you're talking about a group of very strong personalities, very intelligent people.
Yep.
And we have managed to pull, as you know, we just got syndicated, which was
I heard
phenomenal.
That, yeah.
And we've managed to pull this together, and it has turned into something that I'm very proud to be a part of, very proud. And actually, Robin Sachs and Susan Murphy Milano, we are forming this little company and corporation type called Justice Interrupted, and we're going to try and get that off the ground here in the next year or so.
We, as listeners, as viewers, when we watch television news reports, TV shows, read books, look at the internet, you name it, we look at sometimes a one-sided type of reporting, and I think women in crime have gone away from that, and everyone comes on and speaks their mind. As a law enforcement or former law enforcement officer, and you talked about politics, you always had to go in and follow the book, so to speak. You may not have agreed with the book, but you had to follow the book. You had to make sure all the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed. And everyone on the blog talks about that too. But I guess my long rambling question here is, let's talk about the society and the system today. Are we dotting the I's too much and crossing the T's too much, and the bad guy or the bad girl is getting all the breaks and the victim's getting none?
Yeah. And I always said I should have been a police officer in the 60s and 70s.
Me too.
I hear the stories from my father and my uncles, and I'm like, you know, what happened to law enforcement? You know, that, you know, people talk about the thin blue line, and you know what? That is fading, fading, fading away.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'll see it in your smaller departments, you know, the lack of brotherhood, the lack of camaraderie. Is not how it should be. It's not, and I'm not talking about defending, you know, some guy that goes out and some cop that goes out and, you know, murders his girlfriend or something. But right. You know what I'm saying? That sense of brotherhood seems to be dissipating, and I think that's very sad. And with all, you know, you've seen the last 2 years the media take a complete 180.
Yep.
And it is so, just to sit back and look at it. And I know we've been accused of Women in Crime, Inc. of being a lynch mob. And it's like, you know what? I'm going to write what I think. And that's the way it is. If you don't like me, I don't care. This is my thoughts. As an experienced investigator, as a police officer, as a mother, as a person, these are my thoughts. And I'm not going to sugarcoat it, and I'm not going to pacify you. You know, I'm not a celebrity. I'm not on, you know, all these news shows. I mean, I do news shows, but I'm like, you know, not on their payroll.
Right.
And you know, I'm comfortable with that. I'm comfortable with my opinions, and I'm comfortable with what I have to say. And I think the other women are too, which is what makes this so unique. I mean, you've got Catherine Scardino, who is a defense attorney, and I know she wrote one blog denouncing the death penalty.
Yep.
The death penalty. And, you know, we even get in there sometimes and are like, hey, you know what, I don't agree with that. But it's good to do that. We're allowed to say that. And it seems like, I just watched that segment about The View. Did you hear about that?
Yes, I did.
With the Whoopi Goldberg thing?
Yep.
And that makes me so angry. And what makes me angry is the other women sitting around that table are so uncomfortable and so, I think, intimidated by what has been going on to actually stand up and say, you know, speak their mind and say what's right and what's wrong. And I think they're so intimidated and scared by that. And Dana, if I ever make it big someday, you can always play this back to me, because I never want to get like that. I always want to be able to speak my mind no matter what the repercussions.
And you will be able.
People should.
You will be able to, because you've worked the streets and you've been there, done that, and that type of mentality is what sells today, I believe. What's next for you?
Oh gosh, you know, as you know, I just you know, I'm still commissioned through the department. So yesterday I was there all day running the voice stress analysis test, I'm not there full time. But right now, I am. I have a PR firm out of Atlanta that's working very hard for me. I'm doing probably 2 to 3 radio shows a day, some television. In between, I have these 2 book contracts to do by spring, and I just finished the 5th Cece Gallagher book. So, and plus, I have 2 little girls and a husband and a house. So I've been busier now, I think, than I've ever been in my life.
Well, I can tell you what, folks, Angie Dickinson has nothing on this gal. Go to www.
I want to run around in those heels.
Absolutely. www.stacydietrich.com. The book is The Devil's Closet. Thank you, ma'am. Let's stay in touch.
All right, Dana, thanks for having me on. You take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back in just a moment with Amy from Let's Bring Them Home. They've got a special fundraiser coming up with Eddie Money. That'll be a concert that we should all see. This is Dana Pretzer and the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we're back for the last segment of the show this evening. I thought I would bring on Amy Smith. She's one of the directors of the Let's Bring Them Home Advocates for the Missing. Of course, we've done many Let's Bring Them Home shows, although not lately, with LaDonna Meredith. They have a special concert coming up with Eddie Money, and anything that we can do to help Let's Bring Them Home and help find missing people, we certainly will do here on the show. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Nice to have you on the show. Tell us about the Eddie Money concert that's coming up to help the Let's Bring Them Home organization.
Yeah, so this is our second annual concert. Cox Communication graciously provides entertainment. It's a free concert for our area. And last year we brought Air Supply in, and this year Eddie Money will be here. Like I said, it's free to the community, and basically it's just to bring awareness to Let's Bring Them Home and to the families of the missing.
Now, a lot of people that don't know about the Let's Bring Them Home organization, tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. We are a national nonprofit organization that acts as an advocate for the missing and for the families of the missing. We provide crucial resources to those families to get the name of their loved ones out there in the media and to do all we can to help recover them and bring them home. We also do a lot of prevention education. We believe the more prevention we can do, the less recovery we'll have to do.
You know, it's so important when it comes to organizations like yours and others, the education aspect of it, because there are families, sadly, today, actually right while we're talking, that are probably in a panic because they have a loved one missing. They don't know if they should go to the police. They don't know if they should just wait and see what happens. But really, the first 24 or 48 hours is so important. What is your advice to those that are out there listening right now that may need some help?
Absolutely, yeah. The first 24, 48 hours is crucial. And we always suggest, you know, if you suspicion that your loved one has gone missing and there's some circumstances that don't sit well with you, please contact the police and file a report. And the next thing you can do is contact us, and we'll be happy to sit down and evaluate along with law enforcement to see what we can do to help you through the process.
Now, has the education aspect with law enforcement improved some? I know even in my time doing this program that we still run into the odd case where you come into a law enforcement agency and they're just not educated when it comes to helping families and getting missing persons' names on databases and things like that. How's that going?
Sure. You know, it's a slow, gradual process, but it is getting better. The old school, a lot of the times, they don't like to collaborate, unfortunately, with other groups. But we've really seen a tremendous growth in collaboration. The more people that you can get into the pot to help, the better your chances are. So it really allows law enforcement to have extra eyes out there and a different angle to help them, you know, do their job.
Now, we've talked about law enforcement. Let's talk about the news media. It's almost like news media cherry-picks stories. If it's high-profile enough, they'll take it and run with it for a little while. But sometimes stories that should be on the air just don't make it. And I know your organization tries hard to get as many on the air as they can.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, media is eaten up with the blonde-haired, blue-eyed little girl that goes missing. You know, for some reason, that is the attraction in the media. But, you know, the truth is that this is not always the case of the missing. You know, there's a whole different picture and a different face of the missing. And so what we try to do is make sure everyone that goes missing, that they have their time in the media, because the more that they can see their picture, the more they can hear their circumstance, the more they can hear the facts of the case, the more likely that we'll be able to bring them home.
Okay, we've got about 30 seconds left here. We've talked about the Eddie Money concerts. And again, I'll remind the folks to go to www.letsbringthemhome.org for more information and some of the cases that are being featured there. But what else have you got coming up in the next little while?
We are doing a lot of prevention education through our McGriff Safe Kits. We're doing a lot of free IDs. You know, it's back to school time.
Yep.
And a lot of backpack days are happening in our area, and we're just trying to ID as many kids as we can.
Absolutely. It's a great organization. I'm proud to be part of it, and you're welcome on this program anytime. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Danny. I appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Whoops, I hit the wrong button. That's Let's Bring Them Home, and that's me, where I'm going. I'm going home now. That's the end of the program. You have been listening to the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. Go to www.scaredmonkeysradio.com to hear the show live, to listen to podcasts of past shows, daily commentaries, whatever. Don't forget to go to scaredmonkeys.com for all your news and views and information, one of the best blogs that's out there. My name's Dana Pretzer. Like I said, I'm going to go home, and we'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Good night, everyone.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.